It's your girl, Queen Sunny Honey, and welcome to another edition of Freedom Friday. That's right. Welcome to the Caribbean Radio Show. We are the Knowledge Station. And today, of course, we have none other than Dr. Champagne Odin with us. And today's topic is, guess what, guys? Pan-African. Is it dead? No, it's not. But this Hotepism, has it died? Rest in peace. We're going to talk about the topics that we haven't talked about before, because I'm sorry to announce, Pan-Africanism has truly died. Yes, it did. It used to be a rites of passage for the woke folk, but it has rest in peace. From African Bambaataa to numerous celebrities that use the edge of whatever the cultic thing that was, rest in peace, it's died. Yes, you're getting it from a girl whose father is an undertaker, so truly the services and the wake has happened. If you would like to send flowers and everything, honey, send them to yourself, because we need to talk about this today. Dr. Champagne, are you on the line with us?
Yes, I am. Hi, everyone.
Welcome again. Can you let everyone in the audience know just where you are right now and tell us how you are doing?
Oh, well, first, I'm doing fine. I have been a little bit tired these last 2 weeks because I've gone back to university, and I mean gone back and teach. So I started teaching again, and I've also been babysitting these last 2 weeks also. My mother, you guys know I'm always talking about power economics and things like that. And normally I use my babysitting money for stocks and bonds and stuff. But my mother, you know, she needed a little bit more cushion. So I, you know, I've been babysitting. I gave all of that to her yesterday. So she's very happy about that. So that's what I've been doing. That's why I'm a little bit tired right now. Ooh. Oh, and to answer your second question, I'm in Tokyo, Japan, guys.
All right. So yes, ladies and gentlemen, we have our own Pan-African sister. That's Pan. That means all around. And yes, she takes her Africanism with her. And matter of fact, word on the street is that Dr. Odom is about to be married soon. I don't want to spill the tea, but I do want to be the first to spill this one. For people who don't know, aren't you marrying an African?
Yeah, that's in our future plans. That's right.
So, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, if you are a foundational Black American out there and you are just considering love, let Dr. Odin be an example for you that there is a world full of non-foundational Black Americans that in a dating pool just waiting, different cultural values. And coming up later on in the 2022, we'll start to talk about those relationships and what this love looks like on a bigger scale. But let's jump into today's topic. Dr. Odin, can you confirm the death of Pan-Africanism?
Yeah, I think it's a wrap. I really do. And like, for me, like I'm 40. I went abroad, I would say, let's just say 20 years ago, and I could say at that time it was definitely dead, and I'm sure, like, even before them, it was really, really dead. And I was able to confirm that it's really, really dead, I would say in 2000, let's say 17, 18, 19, when I went to Africa, like, 4 times to do business. It's a wrap. It's a wrap. I mean, if you define Pan-Africanism as, okay, we want the Black Americans to bring their money and their expertise and come and build our communities for free, and then African Americans get nothing out of it, then yeah, that's Pan-Africanism. Or, oh, we're going to go to, you know, we're from a third world Black country, but we're going to go to America and live near the Black Americans because they're the ones who are bigged up and they're the ones who have paved the way for us. Then yeah, that's Pan-Africanism, if you want to define it as that. But the real definition is supposed to be Blacks coming together as a group so that we can, you know, fight white supremacy and, you know, have a financial base. But that's a wrap. I just don't see that happening anymore. Shout out to Dr. Claude Anderson. He was saying, like, in his book, Power Economics, how, like, in Asia, you know, I live in Japan, he was saying how the Japanese will help other Asians by having, like, Toyota, Nissan, Honda. They'll go set up plants in those countries, which I've confirmed with my Thai students. You know, they have them in Thailand. They have them in Vietnam. Also, I think also in Malaysia, because I teach some students out there. But he said, you know, and Dr. Claude Anderson was saying, you know, blacks, we need to do the same. And he's absolutely right. However, when we go, and shout out to Tariq Nasheed, like, I've only tried to do business in Africa, but when I've gone there, it's a wrap. Like, I can't get anything done. And it's not like I'm living there, you know what I mean? So if you live there and you are a millionaire, then that's completely different. I'm talking about normal FBA people, like me, like you, just people who, you know, want a different experience. Oh, let's go to Africa. Like, I'm talking about those people. I'm not talking about millionaires. So it's really a wrap. It is, and it's quite sad. It's super sad for me.
You know, Pan-Africanism died to me in middle school. Because that's when we had the mock trial debates and we understood what the United Nations was. And at that time, I realized that we needed a Pan-African delegate in which all Africans, you know, on the planet had this one umbrella that we could speak from our independent nations that would kind of bring us in unity. When I joined the mock trial debate and realized that we were not represented that way and that that would never be, it died. And I agree with you. Once I started traveling to this continent, the fantasy I had from Disney was that, hey, genetically, I'm a part of something. And then I got there and realized that the worship of white supremacy was so much deeper. Jill Scott said on Instagram this week that she wants to move to Holland because escapism for her is leaving America with her black son to a better world. Well, you already know that Holland is known for the black face.
Girl, as in the Netherlands?
Girl, the Neverlands. Yes, ma'am.
The death cat slaves. What is she talking about? Holland? Wow, that's a bit of a reach, but.
Exactly. Or the fact that Stevie Wonder said that he wanted to move to Ghana. I really wish these black celebrities in between T.D. Jakes and Steve Harvey talking about the Middle East, I wish they would have just shut up and move in silence, honestly, because Pan-Africanism is dead. Saying those things, if you have the resources, get out there and go. But as far as the reality, Jill, yeah, you went on concert and those people on stage, they definitely jammed to your music. But right up the street, those players and those blackface festivals are the things that they do.
Oh, yeah, they got Black Pete.
Oh, thank you, Black Pete. Okay. Socially acceptable. For me, it's just a bittersweet thing watching this. It's almost like in African culture, they have this thing where when you're growing up, you go through a rites of passage. So I think being so supposedly woke as a kid, I thought that Pan-Africanism was the thing. There were subcults in the Southeast region called like Nuwabians that were really attractive for a lot of black people to join this particular cult in that time because they represented Pan-Africanism through Dr. Malachi York. And it was just like thousands of black people all over were triggered to go to a place called Eatonville, Georgia. And because this man had thousands of acres, he took all of the holy texts that you would know in a traditional Bible, put black faces on it so it attracted the people for that sign, built a land that showed a Sphinx and all kinds of places, almost like looking at a Las Vegas form of Egypt, and he did that in Georgia, and people just kept going towards these things that were cultic. It was really, at the end of the day, just a way to have you work for free, sell their incense, share your bodies and give your children over to it. So Pan-Africanism truly died so, so long ago that I think that they get to hustle people like the churches do. The same way people say, can a man rob God? And you're like, I don't care if the pastor drives a Maserati. I'm paying my tithes. I don't care where my money goes. I'm in obligation to the divine to send it in. Okay, scammers are gonna scam, so somebody's gotta do it. Now,
Wow.
I got a client, I wanna say this before you jump in. Recently, one of my clients, I do LLCs and help people with their businesses. A woman reached out to me and she wants to move into one of my homes in overseas. And so I was telling her, and she was like, "Oh, I want to go to South Africa." I was like, "Hey, I have a house in South Africa. Why don't you just rent it out for me?" But then, honestly, to not be the businesswoman, I was asking the why. And I discovered that she wanted to take her products and sell it in Africa. And I was just thinking, I was like, instead of putting on this,
Which product?
she has eczema creams and all kinds of natural
Oh,
products. But she didn't realize that these places, they don't need you. You don't actually need to leave America to be successful. You can sell your products everywhere in the world. If you don't need a manufacturer or distributor in a foreign country, why? Just put yourself in a position where you can live anywhere, but don't think that you can get into these other countries and get caught up. They'll bleed you dry. You will go home broke, and they will think that it's replenishable. The unfortunate news was she was taking her family inheritance. Her father had passed away. She was selling the house and wanting to just move. So I made the executive decision. I was like, "Look, sis, I'm gonna be real with you. That Pan-African concept is dead, dead. Stay yo behind in America and thrive even better in your business. Allow your products to be sold everywhere in the world, but don't get up and leave what you have. Don't choose escapism because you're not a part of it." That concept of just thinking that Pan-Africanism was alive, she would get down there, people would open doors for her. No, ma'am.
Yes. And can I just say, I mean, I have like a few things to say, but I'll just stick to one. What you just said is so true. Like, we think that there's an open door, because for the Africans, when they come to America and the Caribbean, so the other blacks, when they come to America, there is a lane for them that we've created. But when we try the reverse, ain't no lane. And I'm not talking about rich folks, I'm talking about the common American. Black American. I'm not talking about one who got thousands of dollars saved. I just mean somebody who's just normal, just a normal person who wants to go to Africa. It's like that lane is not open. Now, I'm not saying you can't do business. Absolutely, you can. But I always tell people in my book, I think it's called three, oh, forget, I forgot the name of the book. But I think it's called like 3 Ways to Make Contracts in Africa. You go, you do, you're done. It's on Amazon. But one of the ways I said, if you want to do business, go as a teacher, you'll have a visa, you'll have a place to stay, and you'll have income, and then you can open your business part-time. But just going and bringing all your money with you, and you don't know what you're doing in Africa, none of us do, because that is not your stomping ground. I mean, there's no lane. There's a lane to get your money taken. So, and I find it to be very hypocritical, because I was talking to my man about it, and I was like, why is it that, like, when we, especially me, when I go to Rwanda and I go to universities and I say, okay, I have a way to get your students jobs in Japan, but they don't want to pay. He was like, well, they think that you should do it for free because you're American. I said, yes, but when they come to Japan or wherever, they don't do anything for free. He said, yeah, I know. He said, but the way that they see it. I said, okay, but do you think that's right? He said, no, I don't think it's right, but that's just the way it is. And I was like, wow. So that's my input there.
I want to share with people who don't understand the free concept has gotten us messed up historically as melanated people. When someone showed up to your continent and offered you something for free, in exchange, you actually got the reflection of yourself out of the water or a book called the Bible, and they took your people, which you thought were contracts. So watch out for something that's free. It's a great sales pitch. I like to remind people that religion itself says this thing is for free, but you're giving your soul. Religion, the foundation of it, is saying, "Hey, give me all of this, your resources in your lifetime, for the hope and promise of a return afterlife." So for black people coming from America, if you're not understanding what Dr. Champagne's saying, let me break this down. Every time the missionaries sent anything to Africa, this was free clothing and free money. So that's the very root to the concept of, oh, Americans give freely. The reality is, and I've lived long enough to see this, I'm over 40 as well, that I've seen priests, I've actually had the experience on the continent of Africa where priests from the Roman Catholic Church that I have met that are flying around the world, giving donations by day and raping the children by night. Much like what goes on in Bangkok and those other regions of the world, the safe haven for, you know, raping children and organ harvesting has been the continent of Africa, because you think it's free money that's given to you, but anything that's given in the daytime, those clothes that are donated, are never donated. Once they get to the continent, they're sold by some girl at a boutique or somebody on the Wednesday market. And you thinking that when you leave and I'm sending these things to Africa, I'm sending it, yes, it costs me money, but these are things I freely give. And then when the sun sets on that experience, those same priests or those missionaries that come in the name of white supremacy under the guise of Jesus, they come up to those same owners of those orphanages, those same people that they donate to, and they make those Pizzagate requests. They make those Hillary Clinton, Bill Clinton requests, which is, send me a 5-year-old little boy. Send me a little infant. And the people who own, who receive all of these things for free 99, they turn a blind eye because they want those donations to keep coming in. So they freely give these children over. Now, this is, I'm just bringing this up, sis, because that's why I say Pan-Africanism has truly died. If you thought the color purple made you the missionary that you was coming over and helping someone, no one put up an ad and said they needed your help. The lane is closed.
That's true. And what you said about them raping the kids, like, you know, as you guys know, I support a small village in Ghana, and I work very closely with the Queen Mother there. And she said, you know, you sending money, books, underwear for the children, she said, you know, that's so valuable. She said, because if you didn't do that, she said, these young girls, like 12, 13, 14, the men would, and she didn't even say white men, she just said men would come and have sex with these young girls and get them pregnant just so that they can eat. And I was like, man, I said, that's horrible. So I'm glad, like, I actually have a business partner who's about her business, and, you know, I totally checked her out. She's legit. But I'm just glad that I can do my small part and stop that from happening, because that's not okay with me. It's not in any country. It's just not all right.
Signs that Pan-Africanism is dead. Have you ever heard of African Bambaataa?
I have, but I'm not too familiar with him. So,
all right. So for everyone who's unfamiliar, let's go back to Hollyweird. Anytime you select someone and they're able to be a celebrity in America, you already know. It has to be a little something iffy if you're not a one-hit wonder. African Bambaataa hit the hip-hop stage, and along with having the lyrics from back in the day that people were like, oh, this is woke, these concepts, he was able to successfully lure in young black males who also wanted to go into being a dancer or being in the industry. And what he would do was, as soon as you got into the big Puff Daddy office, he was a Puff Daddy of his time, he would, you know, show a little porn, and the boys would be like, okay, this is man stuff. You know, these young men are coming from single-parent households, naturally. And then after a while, he would select certain children, certain boys, and those certain personality types, you know, you let the others go out and put out flyers for your shows. You take the weakest one, and you keep him close to you. He began to touch himself, and one of his victims was like, yeah, one day the porn that you would see constantly in his office, he would be standing there touching himself, and then it'd be like, hey, don't leave the room, you can feel comfortable. All of these behaviors led up to the moment where he sodomized this young man. A series of young men have come up with the same story, and they said once the act took place, there is just this embarrassment of saying, well, hey, you have nowhere to go, you have no one to tell. And after a while, a lot of his victims said that they were just sent to other celebrities. Hey, I'll let you meet celebrity so-and-so. So the young man would go, "Hey, I'm okay. I don't want to miss this concert," and would be sent over to someone else's apartment. I could courier and end up having the act constantly happening to them. This is behind the scenes of Hollywood, and a lot of times we're talking about R. Kelly and the heterosexual nature of what happens with young girls. But this is the part of knowing that connected to Pan-Africanism, a lot of these young people don't, they look at it as being so alive, so woke, that this is a path of righteousness. This is a road that leads us to, here's a leader who's saying all the right things about Africa, bringing us together, giving us the vocabulary and the lyrics, only to discover that they were no different than a scamming behind pastor that took all your money and took your virtue as well. So by looking into the news, guys, and looking in the industry, you can understand why Pan-Africanism dead. Because if you can find a black celebrity that wants their kids to go in the industry, let me know.
I don't know any of, I mean, to be honest, let's say Chris Rock, Denzel, I don't even know any of their kids. Like, I've never seen pictures of them. They never talk about them going into Hollywood. So, yeah, I think that's something to think about.
Can you name any aspect of our history and Pan-African that someone that got it right, someone that attempted to do the very thing that we're striving for, bring us together in unity on the globe? Is there anyone?
Well, of course, Garvey. I mean, and it's funny because, like, sometimes I get in arguments with Caribbeans or with Africans, and they're like, "Yeah, well, Garvey was, we gave you Garvey." I'm like, no, player, we gave you Garvey, because Garvey couldn't get it on and popping with the Pan-Africanism in Jamaica, because you guys were cooning so much. He had to come to the States to get with us. So I would say Garvey, definitely. Tariq Nasheed, he's one, but he was saying, like, when he goes to Africa or to the Caribbean, he went to Haiti, he was saying, like, "Listen, I will build houses out of my own pocket. Now, can you guys set it up where us foundational Black Americans, we'll come in with the money, we can buy this land, let's, do a leather industry, let's do something. Can you make that, can you make that pop?" And the answer is always, "Oh, no." At the end of the day. So yeah, I've heard of plenty of our, I don't want to say leaders, but Tariq Nasheed, Garvey, Dr. Claude Anderson, but it's not the FBA who's having the problem, completing the Pan-Africanism. It's the other blacks who are not allowing us to come in, and we're not even coming in on no F-boy stuff. You know what I'm saying? We are coming in to build. But they're like, "Oh, well, you can't do that. We need you to, we somebody needs to vouch for you, and you need to give us this, and you need to do this." So it's just like, it's really frustrating, because, to be honest, they don't want us there. They just want our money, and that's it. So
Well, I want to
I
go
hope
back
they
to
answer.
Garvey, because
Yeah.
before I get into Garvey and Tariq Nasheed, I want to say education, knowledge is truly power, because from the outside looking in, we'll gladly donate but not understand any laws in a foreign land. And I think that throughout history, those men or women who stepped up to the plate, that's when they understood a new law. They stepped into something without fully understanding the law. So Marcus Garvey, the United States made sure you can't put your yacht or boat on anyone's port without permission. So all the legalities that the Garveyite community from way before we were ever born, they experienced was sowing their seeds in a timeshare that never developed, on the hope of what was going on in Liberia and the hope and prayers of the things, the connections he was making with the Caribbean islands. So I look back at history and see where people can legally say that he was a scam artist because their monies disappeared, the ship never left. But at a certain point, he had to answer to the gatekeepers, that is the legal system that took the money to say, "Hey, it takes money to get this sitting here, this ship sits here. Okay, it's going to take money for this and this." Whereas, we don't know, and our ignorance was totally bliss, and you just look to the leader and think that all of those things are panned out. So I look at Marcus Garvey and say, okay, I see the legal issues behind why that was an epic fail, because no one had the whole budget set up to say, okay, black people, in order for this attempt, then I need my 5 million people to give $1 in 1922, and we will be able to make it from point A to point B and take care of all of this. With Tariq Nasheed, he's absolutely correct, but by the time he got to Haiti and tried to do these development projects, he was actually showing us the documentary side of the process. And that was the beautiful part about what Mr. Nasheed gave us, is a chance to learn that there truly is a process. Foundational Black Americans have an issue, in my opinion, that it's almost thinking that whatever our thoughts are, I want to say xenophobic, but to think that we're the know-all, be-all for everything, not understanding that whatever you feel, your freedom of speech, it ends right here on American soil. And whatever the laws of another land, you can't go and sue Africa if you get scammed in any country in Africa. You won't be able to have any legal whatever. And, you know, going back to the children who are molested, that's one of the cases that I constantly watch, these cases where, you know, Oprah Winfrey bestseller came out. One of the girls from The Experience ended up coming to America and living out her life peacefully here, but sharing her story, she knows that there's nothing she can do to help those children who are victims back home, because the U.S. will never have a court case with any country in Africa for the sake of some kids getting raped. Not going to happen. Never going to happen. So when we look at... Yes, ma'am. So, yeah, I want to be quiet and let you take the floor on this death, this funeral.
Oh, yes. I think that one of the points that I wanted to make, when the first country I ever lived in was obviously America, but living abroad was China. There were many and are still many Africans there. Mostly it was the Congolese at the time. And this was like 20 years ago. You know, my best friend is from the Congo, and shout out to her. I just spoke to her last week. I mean, in terms of Pan-Africanism, like, with them, they would say things like, oh, you're a slave. And I'm like, I'm a slave, but you're about to marry a white European French lady. So I just found things like that to be kind of mean. Like, you calling somebody a slave. No, I'm not a slave. I'm a descendant of a slave in America, where all the other blacks want to go. So, you know, why do you want to go there if I'm a slave, you know? And also, like, moving forward to London, you know, that's where I learned the most about other blacks, and I would say about all the other cultures, pretty much. Not all, but most of the other cultures on the planet. I learned all of it in London, and I was especially close with both Caribbean blacks and African blacks too. But they never knew what I was from. They never knew that I was American until they said something like, "Oh, well, you know, if we'd be in the Caribbean or the Black Society Club." They'll be like, yeah, and the Black Americans don't have culture. And I was like, whoa, I said, wait, I'm Black American. What do you mean we don't have culture? Because around the world, you hear rap music. You don't hear African drums. And everybody in here is dressed like Black American. You don't have on a kente cloth. So it was always this, they're trying to jab at us. And I never understood, what is the jab for? Like, I never understood it until, like, I really left America. And then I determined that I think it might be somewhat of a jealousy. And I'm not saying that Black Americans are better than any other blacks. I'm not saying that. But what I'm saying is, because of our American privilege, we have access to things naturally that the other blacks don't. And that could make somebody envious. I get it. Like, for me, myself, you know, being a Black American, like, I've gotten scholarships to go to university. I've gotten scholarship, like, more than, what, 5-6 scholarships to study abroad 5-7 times. Whereas my African counterparts, they don't have those options. So I can understand, like, you being frustrated, like, oh, well, why do the Black Americans get it, but we don't? But the thing is, if you would come to America and let us lace you with gains, shout out to Jason Black, we could help you win. But, and shout out to Jason Black again, he said, when they come, they try to separate from us. And as you can see what happened to the Haitians 2 weeks ago, when you separate from us, you are separated. And all the FBA blacks, I don't think anybody back home did anything, because they're like, but you guys said you were better than us, so, you know, then you need to handle, you know, hold your own coconuts, as Tariq would say. Hold your own nuts. So, like I said, just being abroad in London, just being around the other blacks, has always been this jab or disrespect. And even when they come to their country, it's disrespect. But now I think everybody's kind of getting their wake-up call, because, like, the Haitians got kicked out, and then the Afghans got brought in right before the Haitians got kicked out. And Joe Biden gave the Afghans $6 billion to, like, 37,000 people, which is about $100,000 each per person. So he can bring the Afghans in, give them money. Oh, and by the way, not give Black Americans reparations, but he kicked the Haitians out. So, like, do you see what I'm saying? Like, you guys stay taking L's, and if you would just come to the States, let us lace you with game, let's work together, you could win like we could. And shout out to Jason Black again. Queen Sunny Honey, you know, I don't know if you know, but Bruce's Beach is now being returned back to the Descendants.
Yes.
And Bruce's Beach is now valued at $75 million. Do you understand 100 years of somebody taking your land and your descendants not able to profit off of their birthright? That is a win.
Yes,
that's a
it
win.
Is.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, not to go from an absolute win to a loss. Earlier this week, I was talking with one of my Jamaican homegirls, and she gave me a nice piece of medicine that was bittersweet. Oh, girl, it was bitter. Let me just say, it was a bottle of bitters. And I understood furthermore that Pan-Africanism is dead. She looked at me and said, you know, most people in the Caribbean and on the continent of Africa, we don't understand Black Lives Matter. We don't get it. We don't get you. And I looked at her and I appreciated that level of honesty that she was giving, because in her explanation was saying our adversaries look like us. So, you know, the kindness have come from the from others, but the victimization has come from within, whether it be our own government, all of our atrocities in this life experience. And I got it. You know, when you grow up and you see yourself on the money, and you see your system of your own supremacy amongst your people, your own caste system of people that look like you. I didn't have the gall to tell her, look, I don't do Black Lives Matter, because I know there's nothing more than just a nice little hustle scheme. It had nothing to do with the Black family or even the Black community. It's just pretty much one of those TMZs that just became the poster child for something. But yeah, I knew right then and there, I was like, wow, 99% of Black people in America have no clue that this is the real truth, that people are looking at us from the outside and saying, I'm not on board with you. No, I don't get the Black Lives Matters. Black lives
which
don't
is
matter.
Fine.
It's fine.
That's absolutely fine. Like, and what you're saying about her not being on board with it, that's fine. Well, then you need to stay in your own country and stop letting the Chinese buy up everything. Why don't you, you know, I mean, since obviously you do better than us, then, you know, go back to your country and build. Like, if you've been in America, and, like, there's a lot of Black celebrities that are in America as well that are not FBA. Y'all got millions. Y'all got skills, but why don't y'all want to go home and build up your own community? You know, you guys, for the most part, America, like Black Americans, foundationals, we're what, 13% of the population, and we still win more than all the other Blacks, who are what, 99% of the population? You're 99% of the population, but you don't own anything, you don't control anything. So just, like I said, it's always this fake, phony, oh, we're better than you. You're better than us how? You're coming to America, you're fleeing. You don't see Black Americans getting on boats trying to come to the U.S. You don't see us getting on boats going to the Mediterranean, going to be prostitutes in Europe. You don't see us doing that. So, like I said, I'm just sick of this fake, phony, like, we're better than you guys. How? The only time, like, I really see you guys prosper is when you come around us and get the game. And there's nothing wrong with that. But I think we just need to be honest. But you're absolutely right. The way they see us, we don't get it. But I think, I would say this last year, we get it now. That's why we're all saying FBA, Foundational Black Americans.
That's right. You know, it's refreshing talking with you because sometimes I think it's just me. I would never have been bold enough to tell all the foundational Black Americans some of the stories that I've seen being on the continent, leaving home, about just how sweet it is. You know, I'm a victim of, not even a victim, I'm someone who used the Disney concept and really thought I could escape. Being a child, I sat at the dinner table just spinning the globe, and my mother looked at me. She was like, "Could you stop? What are you doing?" And I, you know, kept spinning the globe and saying, "I'm looking for a place on this earth where Black people are accepted, where there's no racism." And I remember Mama putting the cloth down and saying, "Well, child, when you find it, let me know." So she's actually, you know, no longer living on this planet, and here I am realizing that everywhere that I am, as long as I know who I am, then I am that life. But Pan-Africanism, as far as coming together, not gonna happen, not in this lifetime, not in 250 years from now, because it's really deeply rooted in everyone to survive. Every tribe and tribalism within countries on the continent are going to look out for it themselves. In the Caribbean islands, to know that you're able to get the wealth from the Chinaman or whomever and sell and have, you know, more resources, those things might be more important of survival and priorities than it would be to look at me and say, "Well, Sunita, you want to buy my home at this value. Someone else is offering me $50,000 or $5,000 more. They have more resources." And I'm like, "Well, I want to keep the culture." And they want to build, you know, take it and build something that would exclude you. I have to just look at things legally the way the Garveyites, those, not the Garveyites, but Marcus Garvey had to deal with it. And after his passing, most people don't realize it was his wives that wrote those books, and he just actually spoke, and they were the writers. But the people who are the followers, you don't really have the whole story. I think that our solution for this Pan-Africanism, this death thing, is to stop looking for leaders and be the leader of your own home. What do you think? What are your solutions?
And for me, I'm not about leadership. I'm about having a code. Let the code be the leader. Like I tell people on Instagram, I am not a leader. I'm a code maker. I have a code. I created it. This is what it is. Please follow. That's it. We don't need leaders. We need a code. And what you said is so interesting. You were saying like it's not going to happen for Blacks as a global, you know, entity. And I get that. And it's sad. But when you compare, you know, Pan-Africanism, I guess we can say Pan-Africanism in terms of the white or Asians, they have their tribalism too, but when it comes to helping out each other, like I said, the Japanese do it for Filipinos, for, you know, the third world Asians, they do it for them. White people do it for other whites. But it's just a shame that we can't help the Africans and the Caribbeans because, like when I said, when we go in there to do business, it's always this, "Oh, well, you can't do that, you can't do this." But they let China and Asia come in and do it. So our only thing we can do, FBA, is just build ourselves. And when the other Blacks are ready and they get on code and stop cooning and mammying it up, then we can build. But until they get on our code, it's a wrap. It's been a wrap.
Let me bring Oprah into this conversation. All right, guys. Here is I guess this story time is going to be a nightmare for some of you, so I'm putting a disclaimer on it. Back in the day, people said, you know, asked the question, "What has Oprah done for the Black community?" Then years later, she went to Africa, she built a school, and it gave you guys this healing balm of like, "Oh my gosh, she helped the little poor Africans." That's a lie. This woman decided to do something that's a great business model. Her school is designed for the power elite wealthy. While most of you thought that Africa was impoverished, Oprah built a school where those African world leaders could send their children who traditionally went to school in Europe, left the country. And she looked at this as a niche and said, "How can I get those Africans who in France and all these other regions to actually feel a sense of pride about having education done on the continent somewhere at a school that is worthy?" So from the foundational Black American standpoint, you gave her a pass because you thought that she was doing the philanthropic thing to help the impoverished, when she is only doing she did a very wise marketing strategy with people who have more income than the average Black American ever sees in a lifetime, that all of their children attend her school, and that 1% is that scholarship kid that you thinking is 99% of the school is a bunch of poor kids. No, you would have that one kid that comes in, and that's where the court case came up later on about those kids that were super rich having issues, and then, you know, legally they said there were some issues that were going on her school ground, and it was basically the poor kid that was the victim getting the scholarship, going out and just thinking that tribalism and people are people, and, you know, some things happened at her school, but it wasn't with one of the rich kids. So the next time that you're watching Oprah and you're noticing, oh, she has them in her home in America, baby, those are ambassadors, dignitaries, diplomats, presidents. Those are their children and grandchildren who are in the home. That is not somebody's poor African child. Get it right.
Right. Wow. I didn't even know that. Wow. Because I honestly thought it was a girls' school for poor girls. And you're right. We got to stop thinking that, oh, all of Africa is impoverished. Because not all of it is, and not all the people are, of course. But I thought it was for poor girls. Wow. That's, wow.
Well, one thing, if you go to Europe, all these places, you see a large population of Nigerians, of a lot of African cultures, where they might have gone there and say, hey, my parents came, my father took a job, I was, you know, pretty much born and raised in this region. So they're cut off from the continent. And then, you know, when they would travel home, I understand how it feels. You go and then there's really lights, I don't care. It's not France. It's not the lifestyle. You're not looking at the Eiffel Tower and all those things. So that disconnect there. When you have that much power and wealth and access to different experiences, I look at Oprah and saying, girl, that's what made you a mogul. The Oprah Winfrey Network, the fact that those are acronyms for the word own, you're able to be well-traveled to get a different experience to see, hey, you know, we want to bring them back to the country. We want them to feel that need. And so for her to create the niche where the wealthy feel good about spending money. To everyone out there, you know, shout out. We are the Knowledge Station here at the Caribbean Radio Show. But let me tell you something about the super rich. They don't do sales. Even me, when I'm standing at work one day and I'm looking on the ground and all four of the kids standing around me talking or wearing $1,000 pair of shoes, and they have them in every color. I understood that Kanye West does not have to care about Black foundational Black Americans for the rest of his entire life, because the wealth that he receives from the rest of the world who has the resources to support him, he doesn't have to jump on the Pan-African bandwagon. He can do Super Soul Sundays and have a good choir that'll be a paid choir, not the free choir members back home, that will just set the tone, and everyone else in the world will have. I got students all around me, like, I got five pairs of these shoes, $5,000, that's $1,000 a pair. So knowing that Pan-Africanism is dead, is understanding that whatever that you have, if you ever had a vision or a goal for something, you say, hey, when I was in middle school, I came up with Uber Eats. I came up with whatever FaceTime began. But guess what? You didn't have the resources to make that happen, or you had limitations. These things are going to come to pass by others who are not stuck in the box of Pan-Africanism. Most of the successful people that you see who are foundational Black Americans, they are trying not to put the label of this is a Black-owned business, because they understand that there are other races that are pouring monies in that they don't want to limit themselves to. They'd rather say it's a female-owned, because those people who are successful fully understand Pan-Africanism is dead.
Right. And you know what's funny? That's so true, because most of my base is Asian, especially Japanese. So they love me here. So that's absolutely right. Like, just because we're black does not mean that we cannot sell our products to somebody who's not black, and that doesn't mean that we can't do business with people who are not black. What we're saying on this channel is to always come from a position of power. So don't be in there cooning and, tap dancing and eating your what is it? What does Tyree call it? The butter biscuits.
Yes.
He is so funny. He did something on Twitter today. Man, he makes me laugh. But yeah, so like I said, get off your block. Understand that we can do business with other people, but it has to be from a position of power. And just to interject, when I went, I remember years ago I saw Chris Rock's Good Hair, and I think we learned that a lot of that hair comes from India. So I went to India and I went to the hair store and I was like, "Listen, I want to buy some of that hair." And she's like, "What hair?" I said, "The hair that you guys get at the temple, the temple hair place." And she was like she didn't understand what I was saying. And I was like, "Okay, well, what hair do you have?" And she's like, "She has synthetic." I said, "No, I want human hair." And she just didn't get it. So it made me think, like, wow, so Indian people don't even really know that their own hair, which has been given for free, is being sold to America. And I'm like, well, damn, why can't we go to India and just buy the hair? It's as simple as that. So we have to get off our block if we really want to do business anyways and do business globally.
I agree. Going back to Tariq Nasheed, shout out to you, brother. On his Instagram in the last 24 hours, he put a video of this white guy walking into a Nigerian shop and speaking Yoruba. And I read through the comment section, and most of the people who commented have obviously, I could tell they don't have a passport. They have never left America. And the outrage, the fake outrage that I got from my own foundational Black American brothers and sisters was hilarious to me, because here's this white guy walking into a shop and everyone is going about their day until he speaks their tribal language. And then people in the comments are like, "Oh my gosh, this is worship. This is this and this," all the comments that were made. Well, guess what? It took me back to the time I was in Kenya, in Nairobi, and I remember just early that morning, just walking ashore and then laying out, sleeping, like, just the beauty behind knowing I wasn't gonna get robbed. And I woke up and I saw there's these sticks in the water, and all these old ladies looked like they were in their 80s and 90s were pulling seaweed. And I was so excited that I got up and I started walking towards them. And I promise you, I was like maybe 2 meters away. And then, it hit me. I don't speak their language, and they wouldn't have understood me. And so I bring that reference back to that white guy who spoke the Yoruba language. And I challenge foundational Black Americans to actually get outside the box. Make sure you understand that the school is going to offer French and Spanish, but make sure you give your children the opportunity to be a polyglot, which means you know more than one language. Do that so that you don't cut yourself off. If you're always going to be up in the Asian shops getting your nails and feet done, saying, "I've been going here for 10 years," but you never learned the language, then that's woo on you, because you are sitting in a room with people who are talking about you, and you should know the language. So for this white guy to learn the Yoruba language, I want to just challenge foundational Black Americans. If you have an issue, you ought to be learning the language. And you cannot give me the excuse of saying, "Well, I'm too old." Well, don't have a comment about everything if you only speak English. I think
Exactly.
from the African
That's true.
standpoint, from the Jamaican standpoint, a pigeon, when anytime that you have that thing that you can relate to people with, that connectiveness, that's what's going to get us to keep the unity there. But when you can have your own separate language and you're limited by English alone, the actual language that is not your original language of your people historically, then you have a social responsibility to keep it alive, to learn more.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what's funny? I have a couple of things to say about that. Like my man speaks nine languages, including Japanese. So I mean, that's like, to me, is like, wow. So I love that about him. So our kids, I don't know how many languages they're going to speak, but at least three, four, five. So I'm excited about that. And another thing about the Nigerian, the white guy who went into the Nigerian restaurant, people have to realize that, okay, quick story time. When I was in Rwanda, I was in the, where was I? Was I think I was in the north. There was this white girl, I forget where she was from, but she was in a restaurant speaking, which I don't know if it was Kigali, I don't know which language. And they were like, oh my God, that's so cool. And I was like, wow, I said, oh, here they go. Here they go. But I understood why she was learning the language. And I encourage anybody to do it. But you know, with her, I knew it was some nonsense. So that's one thing. And the thing about if you're going into any Nigerian restaurant, there's three major tribes that are probably in there: Igbo, Yoruba, or Yoruba, or Yoruba, or maybe even Benin. So it might be four of those tribe people because they are the most populous. So the fact that white boy went in there and speaking, you said Yoruba, that means I think he actually researched that, you know what I'm saying, that restaurant. Which language they spoke, because like Nigeria is not like America where it's just one language. It has over 200 languages. So the fact that he did that makes me a little bit suspect of him. But I mean, you are right about him knowing the language. We do need to know the languages. And even when I, like I said, when I was in London, I learned the most about, you know, black cultures, you know, overseas, you know, especially the Caribbeans and the Africans. And I actually learned how to understand pidgin. So I can understand patois, I can understand African pidgin. I can't speak it, but I can understand it and I can answer you back in just my normal, you know, speak. So it's very important to understand these other languages. And even I remember my last man is Nigerian. He is half Benin and Igbo, half Igbo. He and his friend is not Igbo, but his friend might be Yoruba. So sometimes, like, they speak English, but then they'll speak pidgin. And the three of us were in the car, and they were having a whole conversation in pidgin. And I wasn't really I mean, I understood what they were saying, but I wasn't really paying attention because I was just thinking about something else. And then he was like, okay, now repeat back what I just said. I was like, what? He said, tell me what I just said. So I told him exactly what he said in just normal English. And he was surprised that I understood. And I was like, dude, it's English. He said, yeah, but it's pidgin English. I said, it's still English. So it's important to know these other languages.
And I agree with you that this white guy in this Nigerian shop, you say is suspect. That's called, I don't want to call it colonizing anything, but that is you taking the time to learn something, you have a purpose. If you're coming from whatever racial background, you're very intentional with learning that for a come up. That's the key for anyone that sees that post on TikTok. If you see the post on Tariq Nasheed's page, is be intentional with a come up. Have a come up. Now, one of the things I want to challenge foundational Black Americans, since we are acknowledging we are at a funeral service today. If you are around here professing waist beads and that you are saying I'm down with the Orishas, but you don't speak anything other than English, guess what? That's why this video is out here to show you that there are so many people who are going to the white person to learn your Black culture because that particular white person is the most powerful in your land of America to learn the language that you are going to see. Well, I'm a descendant of this, and I'm about Yemenya, I'm about Oshun, and I know Obatala. Okay, but if you take the time to learn the language, start with the songs, get the interpretation, understand that which already belongs to you so that your story will not be retold to you by your very captor who has never, for generations, from the moment that they discovered this wealth on another continent, they keep making sure that, hey, up until now, you keep seeing his descendant come up and say, my grandfather went into Nigeria, set up an oil manufacturer, diamonds, and this, and I keep learning. I learned the Yoruba language because this keeps us in power. You may never know the whys of people, but you better learn the blueprint for success.
That's right. Amen.
When I was a little girl, my mother was like, okay, it's time to go to college. What do you want to major in? And I said, white people. She said, excuse me? I was like, yes, ma'am, because
She's right. You're right on that one.
I just want to study this level of success. I know that I come from a very forgiving religious people that, you can keep the resources. You don't have to give restitution, no reciprocity, nothing back. You're totally forgiven. And you keep all, I mean, the cotton shirts that I'm wearing today, yesterday was cotton picking that you did in the fields. So I want to learn how to be just that successful that you have all of the manifestations and the forgiveness. You have the house, the land, you provide the jobs, and they continue to be those who want to work for you. And you are given, you're just exonerated. Why? You don't need to be exonerated from behind bars. They don't do that to you in the penal system. But as an entire foundational Black American race, we have exonerated everyone for every atrocity. So yes, that's what I want to major in. And I look at my life now and say, I live amongst, in my entire life, have always been around a lot of super rich, watching the blueprints. And I'm really excited to say that the way I got out of America was through my students, to know that I live in the richest nation on the planet. My challenge as an educator is to make sure that as they respect me, value me, I don't soak all that in. I'm like, yeah, right, prove it. And that's that line of wealth and receiving what that which is generational coming back to me. That is that prove it. I'm not going to sit here and be a pawn to the words. I love you too much. I love you too much. Prove it by opening these doors, because you have the, I have parents who will tell me, I don't care about my kids getting an A or an F, because we just, if you ask a kid where I'm in the classroom, who wants to be a millionaire, no one raised their hand because their grandparents were millionaires. They're like billionaires. Come on. I can't go into too many details, but there is a child who told me recently, they lost $50 million in a day, and it was nothing. And it just happened recently. He's like, oh, yeah. Oh, well. It's like, to the actual foundational Black American out there, if you are looking up to celebrities, there's no celebrity that you know in America can afford to have a $50 million day loss. And like, it's nothing.
Sound like that hurt. You get a pain immediately.
It was not even, it was a mosquito bite. It's like, okay, whatever. It's just small. So I want us to operate into the limitless blessings that you say you came from, kings and queens. Carry yourself in a dignified way that you understand no one is coming to save your black ass. I repeat, no one is coming to save your black ass. Sky Daddy is not coming for you. Them buttered biscuits, you can sit there and pass on your children and keep on the legacy that you are living, or you can be into power economics and read, Dr. Claude, look into what the historians who have worked into the White House, worked in economics, and get your stuff together, because this Pan-African concept is dead.
It's a wrap. It's, yep. Yeah. And what's funny is that I didn't go to the continent till I was 36, and I still didn't really get how the other blacks viewed us until I went, and I was like, oh, I said, oh, I see what this is. I was like, okay, I understand now. I said, because we always want to think, oh, there's Wakanda and they're going to welcome us. No, they're not. That's what we do. We are the Wakandas. We are the welcomers. It ain't the other way around.
That's right. So thank you so much, Dr. Champagne, and to everybody out there. We're going to have part two of this, because this is just getting hot and popping. And after the funeral, the repast will be next Freedom Friday. So you guys stay tuned. Do bye bye, boo.